Back in 2013, the book The Child Catchers brought attention to the darker side of how certain evangelical congregations and their beliefs about the gospel affected how they practiced adoption around the world. One of the things I found interesting in this book is how author Catherine Joyce took a detached journalistic view of this topic. She went right to sources like adoptees and villages in Ethiopia and other countries. Even though time has passed, I think Catherine and her research have perspectives on adoption that we should be considering and discussing. So I'll be talking to Catherine Joyce today on Adoption Uncovered. Well, hello, and if you could introduce yourself and tell me who you are.
Sure. My name is Catherine Joyce. I'm an investigative journalist who's written about a lot of topics, including adoption and child welfare and religion. And I'm the author of a book that came out in 2013, The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. What do you two wanting to report on adoption and the things that you did choose to report on related to that?
Well, I started paying attention to adoption and reporting on it around 2008. I had started my career about 5 years earlier out of both happenstance and interest. Had gravitated towards reporting on religion and particularly conservative evangelical communities, or sometimes conservative fundamentalist communities, which I'm not using in a pejorative way, but just to distinguish between, evangelical is a lot more mainstream of, a community than some fundamentalist Christian communities. I had published, it came out in early 2009, my first book was about a pretty small subculture of, that many adherents of which use the term quiverful. So these were families that believed in having as many children as God gives them for a variety of reasons. So they tended to have large biological families. Towards the end of the time that I was reporting on that, I started noticing that a lot of those families, and again, this was a smaller subculture, that they were starting to adopt in large numbers as well. Both large numbers of these families were getting interested in adoption, and also a number of them were starting to adopt a lot of kids at once. That just piqued my curiosity because I think a lot of people who don't have a direct connection to adoption, tend to look at it as, this is something, that maybe a lot of families turn to because they're struggling with fertility or something like this. And so here I was seeing these families that were kind of prolifically fertile, families that might have 6 or 10 kids that were then going and adopting a lot. So it was obviously coming from a different motivation. And I wanted to understand that. And I started off looking at this particular subculture or community, and then realized that there was something going on more broadly within much more mainstream Christian circles within, large swaths of the evangelical church as well, that there was starting to be this adoption movement. So that's really how I started looking at it, was coming through the lens of being a religion reporter and trying to understand this as a religion story. And I think the more that I reported on it, the more I realized the various issues that were coming up in looking at this Christian adoption movement applied much more broadly to kind of questions of adoption as a whole. And I'll also just say that, in all of my reporting, I had been coming at this as somebody who was a secular left-wing feminist, very concerned not just with reproductive rights, but with the idea of reproductive justice, which is this concept that's broader than just reproductive rights. Reproductive justice also kind of considers that alongside women's, right to control when and where they might have children, they have a right to be parents, to have their children, to raise their children in safety and kind of with support. So I was kind of looking at it through all of these different lenses.
One of the things Catherine talks about in her book that isn't often discussed is that we as Americans have one view of what an orphanage is. That is often not the same view as the people have in the actual communities that we are often adopting from.
Something that I think I saw highlighted in your book is that very often we have this superficial view of, poor children are in orphanages and need to be adopted, when very often in other countries, orphanages are viewed in a completely different way, as almost like a support system or a place to go when you need help with your children. Can you speak to some of that about how orphanages in other countries are viewed differently than how we would view them in America?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was definitely a big lesson for me as I was reporting. Yeah, was the idea that orphanage does not mean it doesn't equal, orphan. It doesn't mean that every child that is in there is an orphan in the way that we think of that term in the United States, or I don't know where all of your viewership is. But it doesn't here in the US, if we say orphan, we don't tend to mean a child that has lost one of their parents. We also don't tend to mean a child that maybe has even lost both of their parents, but is living with aunts and uncles or grandparents, or other family members or family friends. We think of orphan, we think of Oliver, we think of a child all alone in the world. But in so many countries, institutional care can mean so many different things. It can be a place where parents will, send their children in order to obtain an education because schooling is not free in their community. And, they understand if their child goes and lives there, they are going to get access to something that they would not be able to afford to provide for them. It can be a place where parents put their children when they're going through some sort of temporary crisis. Could be, a financial crisis, could be, a death in the family. It could be the dissolution of, a marriage or a partnership between the parents of that kid, but not putting that child in an orphanage because they are washing their hands of that child or, intend to sever ties permanently. Related to that, another of the things that I learned that was really interesting, is that the notion of adoption that we have here in the United States is just really not a universal concept in a number of other countries. The idea of adoption that we have in the United States, which is the permanent severing of one set of familial relationships between parents and children, or between the child and all of their other extended family as well. And then they go and they are incorporated into a new family and, with this kind of the legal narrative that this is their family, they have no other family. That's just not the way a lot of other cultures see adoption. Many other cultures, of course, have a need for something, some sort of framework where a child needs to live with another family, either temporarily or permanently. But a lot of times that is structured, more like a guardianship. There's never this sense that you are no longer your parents' children. And that was something that came up kind of a number of times when I was reporting, including in Ethiopia, where I met families that would say, we sent our child to be adopted because we understood they were going to go to the United States, get a fantastic education, and this is a way for them to get ahead. And ultimately, it's a way for them to help the family back home in Ethiopia. But never this sense that this is no longer my child. That kind of core cultural disconnect, I think, was really hurtful to a lot of people on all sides. Hurtful to those parents when they realized later this is actually legally what they had agreed to. Hurtful to the adoptive parents, some of whom had been told really completely fictitious backstories for the children that they adopted, told that these children had lost both their parents, that they were all alone in the world, and then come to find out that's not true. And absolutely, very hurtful for some of these children who ended up being adopted and, felt abandoned by their family, felt disconnected, or sometimes like they had been stolen by their adoptive parents. And I think a lot of these things are, they're the fallout of what happens when adoption becomes something that's like a mass movement or kind of a mass market. These really sensitive individual kind of lives get wrapped up in something that's kind of being packaged for mass consumption.
In pursuit of the truth around international adoption, Catherine followed her curiosity to a village in Ethiopia to discover what they thought allowing their children to leave the country meant. She found a very different understanding of adoption from what we have in America.
I would love for you to get into even like more detail about your experience in Ethiopia. What was that experience that you had interacting with first families over there?
Sure. I mean, I have to caveat this by saying my view of this is a little dated, and I can't give the most accurate window into what's going on over there now. And in a lot of countries, as I know you know very well, like laws have changed. In some of these countries, adoption's just not really happening that much anymore internationally. But when I was in When I was in Ethiopia, I focused a lot on one particular family. There was a group of sisters who had been adopted to the United States. The prospective adoptive parents who became the adoptive parents in the US were told a story, that these children were essentially HIV/AIDS orphans. They had lost their mother, but back home in Ethiopia, I ended up meeting with some of the family that was left there, and they were sort of shocked to hear that this was the narrative that had been told, because it was not a particularly poor family. I mean, by US standards, sure, absolutely. By Ethiopian standards, fairly middle class. The father had a job within civil service. They had a home. They had seen this opportunity as one that was going to, ease the financial burdens on the family by finding a way to get these girls an education and, ease some of that strain on the family financially. But they really had the assumption that all of their kids were going to come back. And they were offended by the idea that they ever would have, gotten rid of them, or abandoned them or let them go. The children who were adopted, these sisters, struggled really mightily, with feeling abandoned. It had just really lifelong impacts for everybody on all sides of that. The knowledge that it was that adoption had sort of been founded on a significant misrepresentation of the situation is really hard to square, but it was also something that at that time, and again, I am talking about a period that's 11, 12 years ago. Now it's kind of quite a ways in the past. But at that time, there were starting to be a number of stories like this coming out of Ethiopia. There was, I think it's the Australian Broadcasting Company, I think that's what ABC in Australia stands for. They had an investigative report that was hugely impactful, where they had obtained some footage that a particular adoption agency had taken of, what was essentially a trip that kind of somebody who was working for them had taken to a rural village in Ethiopia, and it it just really appeared as though it was a recruitment effort. There was this video evidence of this person standing in the middle of this village saying, "If you want your kids to go to America, please come stand over here. If you don't, please go over there." And then just started kind of doing these video interviews with these families. Here is this child. They are this old. They like this. Seeing it in just stark kind of video footage like that of, do you want your child to go to America? It gives you a sense of, I guess, both the line that was being kind of sold to some families in Ethiopia, and also, the vast potential for cultural misunderstanding that's embodied within that. I did some reporting where I spoke with somebody who was not directly an adoption agency employee, but somebody who worked at an orphanage that worked with adoption agencies here in the US. So they cared for children who then were adopted through this agency to families in the United States. And some of the things that this person said were fairly shocking to me. Suggesting you have to understand that in Ethiopia, parents don't feel the same way about their children as we do. I was in this meeting with a couple of Ethiopian men who were, either taking pictures or, helping me get around and translate where that was necessary. And I asked them later, what did you make of that? And of course, as you can imagine, they were pretty deeply offended.
Catherine found that the exchange of money for adoption sometimes has unintended side effects.
A lot of the agencies that have been focused on Guatemala, they moved on to Ethiopia. So you could kind of see, and E.J. Graff writes about this, the way adoption hotspot countries kind of hopped from one place to another, and the patterns would repeat themselves in place after place. Frequently, it would be a place that did have some legitimate existing need. But then, this kind of adoption machinery ends up descending on the country, and it ends up having this distorting effect. They are bringing with them, a significant amount of Western money, and that money starts to distort the situation on the ground. There were a certain number of children who, were legitimately in need of, some family situation outside of their own. But then suddenly there's hundreds or thousands of people from the US or countries in Europe, that are willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars to adopt a child. And it's not as though, of course, those tens of thousands of dollars are going, directly to an orphanage in Ethiopia or anywhere else. But a portion of it does. And there's all these other ways that that money gets sort of spread around. Some of the adoption agencies that, would be approved to facilitate adoptions from a certain country, they would be offering to, do certain kind of public works programs in a sense to, we will create this thing that will benefit the community. We will kind of build this institution, or we will support these institutions, or build this school, or things like that. So there's that level that the money is coming in, sort of distorting. There's the relationships that are forged with orphanages or children's institutions, where it becomes this sort of benefactor relationship. These sorts of orphanages are receiving, some support and funding directly from adoption agencies. So there starts to become a bit of a relationship where there's an implicit, at least, pressure to have, children of the sort that people are interested in adopting most. There's also kind of like all of these, kind of trickle down ways that, there's various middlemen, and then there are the hotels that Western families might stay in for months at a time as they're waiting to go through the process. There are drivers who are making money, taking families to Lalabella, while they are going through a very long, kind of an arduous wait to go through all of, the legal and bureaucratic kind of machinery of getting this done. There's translators, there's, restaurants. Like, there's kind of a whole economic structure, both in obvious ways and less obvious ways, starts to be built up around this. And that ends up, that's an incentive. And as, some of the people I spoke with from UNICEF or from other, children's welfare organizations, some of which were demonized as being anti-adoption because they would raise these points, they would point out, this creates this whole incentive structure where, there is a country that has a population of children that needs a certain sort of support or various forms of support. And, there are some solutions for this that cost the country money, and there are some solutions for this that basically bring the country money. So all other things being equal, which do you think is going to go ahead more easily? And it's usually the one that's not costing money, or that maybe even is, bringing some sort of economic benefit. And so a long way around saying it's not as though, these children are being sold by their countries, or that the really exorbitant cost of adoption in the US is getting transferred directly to, an orphanage director or anything like that. But there's all of this economic infrastructure that gets kind of built up around this system.
What I'm hearing from you too is like there are a handful of kids, there are some kids that would benefit from being in American homes, but overall the system is really way more complicated than just that story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's always going to be situations of children who are going to need some sort of care that is outside of their family for all kinds of reasons, because like they are legitimate orphans, or because there truly is nobody else in their family or community who is able to care for them, or because they legitimately weren't safe. And not just because we are kind of expanding the definition of, what is neglect to encompass basically everything that is poverty. It's likely that that's always going to be an issue. I think, the principles that people on paper agree to, that there is this kind of hierarchy of, ways that this should be addressed, that, children should remain in their family if at all possible, then extended family. If that's not possible, then local community. If that's not possible, then stay within their country. And then international adoption kind of falls at the bottom of that list. But because of these sort of perverse financial incentives, all of that gets reversed. But I don't think I, to your original question, I mean, I do think that there is, always probably going to be some measure of need. It's just the way the system has been structured in the past is one that doesn't really address that. And also, I mean, one of the, just kind of as a side note, one of the interesting things I learned in Ethiopia is if you drive around, there are, at least, 12 years ago, driving around in like Addis Ababa. Addis Ababa, I'm sorry. There were a lot of kids on the street. There were a lot of kids who, really seemed like they were on their own. Those are not children who pretty much ever were going to be available for adoption. The two systems, like street children, kind of as they were termed, were not ever going to be in any pipeline that was going to lead to adoption. And instead, a lot of times the kids who were being sent over to the US were from families that were intact but very poor.
The pictures of poor orphans that some of us imagine from countries like Ethiopia or Uganda
are rarely the children who find themselves in safe American homes.
And I would love you to talk more about that, because I feel like in my early days of getting into adoption, that's totally the superficial view I had, is that, oh, there's these poor children begging. I want to give them a chance. And it's like, oh, that situation and the kind of children that do end up becoming available for adoption, those are two different things. Can you speak a little more to what you found about that?
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't do a ton of in-depth reporting on the plight of street children. It was just, you know, part of the context of doing reporting on adoption in Ethiopia. But yeah, I mean, kids who are, you know, effectively homeless, who are living on their own, who, you know, probably most of the kids that you would encounter who are begging on the streets, they're not in the sort of pipeline that would allow them to be adopted. They don't have kind of the paper trail, accurate or kind of forged and fraudulent, that would allow an adoption agency to work with, you know, an approved children's institution or orphanage to get them started on the process to where they would be adopted. It's just this sort of mismatch of this really potent image of a crisis that I think, you know, rightly touches us all and concerns us all, and then the reality of kind of how the bureaucracy functions. And I can't say that I know enough about the particularity of how that would work in other countries. That's really the place I encountered that was in Ethiopia. I would be very unsurprised to learn that, you know, it's a similar sort of scenario in a number of other countries. But adoption agencies, they could facilitate adoptions from, you know, certain institutions that, you know, had approval from the government. Paperwork had to be brought before judges, you know, forms had to be signed off. If a child is actually truly like destitute and on their own and living on the street, well, for one thing, a lot of those kids themselves have very complicated backstories, you know, not all of which translates to pure orphan either, but they just would not be in any of the institutional settings where, you know, through which that kind of that paperwork and those approvals could be obtained to allow them to be adopted internationally.
In her travels, Catherine came across a situation in Uganda that seemed like a promising way to help children who need to leave their first families stay within their community and culture via local foster care. While foster care does occur in African countries, it has not been studied enough to understand how common it is within different communities.
So in your reporting, I'd be interested to know, were there organizations or things that you saw that were really contributing positively to children in these countries?
And I mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation, but, you know, I just keep caveating this, that the reporting I did was over a decade ago. And the movement that I was reporting on originally, the Christian adoption movement or the evangelical adoption movement, is very different today than it was then. And part of that's just due to the realities of international adoption is a tiny fraction in numbers wise of what it used to be. But I also think a number of people who had been involved with that movement started to focus on some other projects that were, you know, intending to help children, but through other means than international adoption. So I do just kind of want to give credit where credit is due, that I think a number of people who were, you know, part of this movement or were drawn to it did sort of reassess. And I'm aware of at least a number of them that kind of redirected their energies towards things, you know, various forms of family preservation efforts, or at least kind of efforts to support alternatives to international adoption at least as, you know, as a first resort. In 2016, I had the chance to do some reporting in Uganda, looking at what was then just a very small pilot program to try to create something like a foster care system within Ugandan communities so that children whose families might have been in crisis for one reason or another, and whose kids might otherwise have been put into an institution or orphanage from which they might have been, you know, sent for international adoption, that they could instead perhaps stay in a family, in the community, give the mother, give the parents, sort of a chance to get back on their feet before a permanent solution to what might have been a temporary problem is arrived at, basically. And so I got to follow a case of that happening with one young mother who had a son, and she was having a mental health crisis, basically, and she was not in a good way. She herself had emigrated from a neighboring country, didn't have a lot of family support around her, and seemed clear had kind of some trauma in her background that she was reacting to, all of which was making it hard for her to be a really kind of present and effective mother to her young son. And so this pilot foster care program brought her young son to an older couple nearby. They're lovely, kind of beautiful people who, you know, old enough to be this boy's grandson, grandparents. And yeah, they cared for him for a number of months. I had the chance that year to be in Uganda twice, so I was there very soon after the boy had been placed with this family, and then about 4 or 5 months later, I was there when the mother was able to. She had gotten treatment. She had done well enough that she had been, you know, released, and she was able to go pick her son back up and try to embark on a new life together. And it was profoundly moving to see the foster family. Frankly, was clearly heartbroken to let this beautiful, wonderful little boy go back to his mother. But on the other hand, there had been this nonprofit that had been taking the mother every week to go visit him, so that he wouldn't, you know, forget his mother or, you know, kind of be confused about what was happening. At the end, the foster family, they invited their pastor to come and kind of preside over a ceremony of returning the boy to his mother, and gave really powerful speeches. They wrote his name into their family Bible. It was, I don't know, it was kind of an amazing thing to watch, to see all of the complicated emotions that are around this, and, you know, to see how hard it was, obviously, for the foster family to give this boy that they had come to love so deeply back to his mother. But then understanding, you know, this is the right thing to do. She had a hard time. There are no guarantees. But she's gotten treatment. She has the right to try again. That was a very small scale program. At the time, it was not clear to me, you know, how feasible it would be to scale it up. And here in the US, our own child welfare system is absolutely not without problems. And that was kind of this interesting tension that I was sort of holding reporting on this to say, on one hand, yes, I mean, how fantastic would it be for Uganda to have to create a modern child welfare system so that when you have these temporary crises, there is another alternative besides, you know, the threat that a family could lose their children forever because they lost a job and got broke, or, you know, one of the parents died and they got broke, or somebody has a nervous breakdown, or a divorce or whatever else happens. And then here in the United States, our own system is so deeply imperfect. I don't think there is a super clear cut or easy answer to that. But I do think, the move towards more local solutions, at least as, the first options, the first priorities, is the right one. It's what most of kind of the agencies and groups that are involved with international child welfare say is the best path, and have said for a long time. But when, again, going back to what we said before, when there is a situation where one solution to children in need brings money and one costs a lot of money, that has always been an obstacle to dealing with it. And so I don't know, I hold out hope for things like that, that those could be solutions.
While international adoption is less common than it was in 2013, and the countries releasing children to the US are different now than they were when this book was written, so much of this book is still relevant today. If nothing else, I feel like the information in this book has the potential to start interesting conversations so we can find creative and ethical solutions for children in need of care outside of our country, whether that's adoption or something else. For more information about Catherine and her book, The Child Catchers, go to my website, adoptionuncovered.com, and thank you.